Today's podcast is sponsored by NoCD. As a telehealth company that specializes in treating people with OCD, NoCD offers live, face-to-face telehealth sessions with licensed therapists and 24/7 support between sessions from peer communities and self-help tools. If you're interested in OCD, you can book a free 15-minute phone call with their team to tell them about your OCD journey, learn about the clinical qualifications of each OCD therapist, and understand why OCD makes its therapy sessions affordable and convenient. To book a call, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. Link is also in the description of this episode. Hey guys, and welcome to episode 220 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I got back on Dr. Patrick McGrath. Patrick is Head of Clinical Services at NoCD. And I got him on because I wanted to go into more depth around his book, which is the OCD Answer Book, where he addresses more than 250 key questions around OCD. And I really enjoyed this episode because I got to ask him some questions that take it right back to the basics, you know, what is an obsession, what is a compulsion, and some of the more, I don't want to say complex, but definitely different questions that maybe I haven't addressed on the podcast before. So for me, it was fun asking him these questions and hearing his answers. I always like the way he brings in analogies and metaphors into explaining OCD and its treatment. So some of the questions, other than the two I just mentioned, is also, is it possible to grow out of OCD? Does OCD run in families? What increases my risk of OCD? If I fix one compulsion, will another one just take its place? Why do I have these thoughts when I don't want to? What are the early manifestations of OCD? How many people suffer from OCD? How can you differentiate between OCD and normal fears and worries? Then I ask him about the weekly webinars he does in the NoCD platform, and he shares a few questions that have been coming up recently on those live webinars. I ask him two of my own questions, for example, what is an ideal ERP mindset? And then I ask him, what is the RP, the response prevention part of ERP, and why is it important? Which I think is an important distinction, so it was great to get him to explain that. And there's so much more in this episode, but yeah, I really enjoyed going through some of the questions that are actually from his book, and obviously there are many more in the book. So I hope you enjoy this episode, and without further ado, here is Dr. Patrick McGrath. On the podcast today, I am joined by Dr. Patrick McGrath. Patrick is Head of Clinical Services at NoCD. Patrick is also a member of the Scientific Advisory Board and Conference Planning Committee of the International OCD Foundation, as well as author of the OCD Answer Book, Professional Answers to More Than 250 Top Questions About OCD. Welcome back to the show, Patrick.
Always good to be back with you, Stu.
It's good to have you here again. And of course, our original episode was about OCD and addiction, so I'll link to that, anyone interested. And we did a bonus episode recently where we go into telehealth and your work at NoCD, so I'll also link to that. But this one, I thought we could get to answering some questions, you know, sure, seeing as that's what your book's about. So, but I guess before that, since we last spoke on the OCD and addiction episode, I guess what's new with you generally, work-wise, OCD, etc.?
Sure. Well, I still consult at AMITA, where I was at before, in the Foglia Family Foundation Residential Treatment Center, which is doing work with OCD and substance use for co-occurring disorders. And they are still open, even in the midst of the COVID issues that we're seeing right now. So they are still taking patients if people are looking for residential treatment. But my big switch 2 months ago now was becoming the head of clinical services for NoCD. And Stephanie Lonsway, who was here in this position before me, who was actually a former student of mine, was deciding to make some changes as she went on maternity leave, and that made an opening. And who knew 8 weeks ago that choosing to go to work for a teletherapy company would be one of the best decisions I would ever make in my entire life, because it was right before all of this stuff hit with COVID. And so everyone else scrambling to go into teletherapy, we were here and ready to go and up and running. And we've seen some amazing increases in our services in the midst of all of this too. So
of course, it's timely, right? Everyone at the minute has to kind of switch to teletherapy because you can't necessarily go into your therapist's office currently. So you guys have done the work and you're already kind of had the infrastructure to do teletherapy. So I guess you're ideally placed to help people at this time.
Absolutely. And it's been wonderful meeting new clinicians who are joining us and who are getting trained. And it's just such a great experience to see people get help and the people that are on the app who are supporting each other as well, and people are using the therapy tools that are built into the app. It's very, very exciting time for the OCD community. Even in the midst of all of this that's going on, I am so proud of people who continue to fight the good fight and to do their exposure and response prevention therapy, even if it's had to be modified. And even if we've changed some of the guidelines for how we're doing it, it's amazing to watch people adjust and still want to make sure that they can do whatever they can to challenge their OCD.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And I guess before we get into the main questions, one that comes to mind is, what have you seen within the community and in whether it's any clients you've worked with or therapists you're working, you're training and they're working with, how are people reacting with OCD reacting to the coronavirus? Is it kind of making them worse, or some of them it's they're handling it well, or what? Yeah.
Well, I get that question a lot, even from people outside of the OCD community who make general broad assumptions, like, man, all your patients must be really getting worse during this. And I say, well, maybe if they have some type of harm where they're afraid they would spread the virus to someone, or if they have contamination fears. But otherwise, any of my patients who don't have those have told me they just don't really care because they're far more concerned about their kind of OCD than they are about the virus. So, and it was funny, I had a patient yesterday who, and I asked him specifically how he was doing with all of this, and he said, yeah, I'm just too concerned if I ran someone over with my car, so I don't really care about the virus right now. So, he was so focused on that. So, for the people who have contamination issues or the harm issues are about if I could spread this to someone, it's been a difficult time, but I again am very proud of the people who I'm working with who have those concerns, who are purposely doing what they can to keep on trying to challenge themselves throughout all of this. Have we all had to make a shift in the way we do some of our work and our exposures? Absolutely, right? We have. But our patients have joined us on that journey as well too. And I think it just shows the amazing bravery that they have in the midst of all of this, where they many people could see that this would be a chance just to say, see, I told you I knew something like this was coming, and I've been preparing for this all along. That so many of them are saying, I can't let this be another thing that just burdens me down in my life, and I've got to work on dealing with this too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Cool. Now I wanted to ask that because yeah, you're right. Some people have make the assumption that because you have OCD, you're instantly going to be more anxious than the general public. But I've also seen people with OCD that are far calmer about it than the general public because they've been taught how to deal with uncertainty and anxiety if they've gone through therapy. Cool. So let's get into this. So these are actually questions that I pulled off of Amazon and another website that were from your kind that were was promoting your book, which is
Oh,
the
okay.
OCD Answer book. So there are questions that I'm guessing are in your book, but I thought it would be good because some of these seem simple, like the first couple, but I think sometimes the simplest questions can give the best results. And I also think it's best it's important to clarify even things that people that listen to this show all the time. It's important to go back to basics sometimes. So, first question, what is an obsession?
Well, three things that we really look at: an intrusive thought, image, or urge that someone experiences as anxiety provoking, and that kind of gets stuck in your head and that you have a real trouble getting out of there unless you do something to neutralize it. So that neutralization could very well be related to it or it might not, right? And some people would just say, well, I get if the simplest one, especially in today's world, if I get a germ on my hand, I wash my hands, that makes sense. But it could also be that if I don't close the car door right, someone in my family might die. So you can see where obsessions can just take a full range of anything. And I always tell people anything could become an obsession. Whatever it might be, you could somehow start to worry about something being wrong about something, and then thinking that you must do a thing to reverse that or neutralize it in some way.
Yeah, no, thank you. And leads me on to the next one. And thank you so much for not saying the word, because you definitely alluded to it there, which is, what is a compulsion?
Oh, maybe I anticipated that was the next question. Yeah. So I didn't say compulsion. But the compulsion really is that neutralization effort that somebody does. And it could be mental or physical. So sometimes in families, there's a difficulty because the family member will say, well, you don't have OCD. I don't see you cleaning things, or I don't see you straightening things up. And that shows a lack of recognition of what compulsion really is, because half of compulsions are things you're not going to see. It might be counting. It might be praying. It might be having to neutralize the bad, quote unquote, thing I said with a good thing that I now have to say. So we can't just rely on watching for the compulsion. We have to really investigate to see if there is a compulsion that's occurring.
Mm. No, thank you. And this next one, it may seem a bit odd, but like I remember when I was 16 and first tried to Google what was going on in my head, and I came across a website, and I'm pretty sure it was a legit one. I'm not going to name who I think it was. I remember reading about, I was when I figured out it was OCD, I was then trying to figure out, well, what do I need to do to get rid of it, and will it ever go by itself? And I'm pretty sure on this legit website, it said you need XYZ therapy. At the time, it must have said ERP or CBT. But then I swear it said something along the lines of, but some people kind of grow out of it by the time they're like 40 or something like that. And so the question is, is it possible to grow out of OCD?
You know, it's interesting. What we see sometimes from research studies, where I've seen that quote as well, too, that a small percentage will maybe grow out of it by 40, or even 1-2% of people either just have an obsession or a compulsion, not both. In my clinical practice, I've never seen someone who had just an obsession or just a compulsion. Mm. And I've not yet met anyone who told me, yeah, I used to have OCD, then I grew out of it. Now, maybe that's just because I see people with OCD. So those people who grew out of it don't call me and say, just wanted to let you know I grew out of my OCD. But I haven't heard any even anecdotal information from anyone I know who's ever heard of anyone that's happened to. So it's sometimes interesting about maybe the definitions they used in papers or for research or literature reviews are slightly different than what we're considering to be actually cured or grown out of something. Yeah. In the sense of maybe grown out to that meant that, yeah, I still have an intrusive thought now and then, it just doesn't bother me. So maybe they're looking at that and saying, and sure, all of us have intrusive thoughts. So let's just make that clear that everybody in the world experiences them. I would just find it odd that somebody who has had OCD would never again feel the twinge or urge or something at some point in time in their life. And I mean, you know, people like you and others that we know who have done so amazingly well with challenging their OCD still have days where it's like, oh, I'd like to creep back in there for a little while. Yeah. If you don't mind. And you're like, get back down there. Kind of things.
Yeah, no, thank you for answering that. And I guess, yeah, like you said, it could be how the researchers are measuring, because that person could currently for the last year have, sometimes OCD ebbs and flows for some people. Yeah. And it could have just, they've had no anxiety or little anxiety, and therefore I don't have OCD anymore, I'm cured.
Yeah.
When in reality it could come back.
Right.
Cool. All right. And next question is, does OCD run in families?
Yeah, we do see that if there's a first degree relative with OCD, your chance of having OCD is higher. If it's an identical twin, it's higher than if it's a dizygotic twin. So we'll definitely see that there are some genetic links that go on with obsessive compulsive disorder, both for actual diagnosis of OCD and for probably people who meet some of those subclinical types of symptoms, that they may have some intrusive thoughts and do tiny little things. It doesn't equal the hour long time, or it doesn't distress them to the level that someone with the actual diagnosis of OCD might have, but it's still there. So we definitely do see that there's some genetic components. And even in the new DSM, the DSM-5, I think it made some changes. You know, it took OCD out of the anxiety disorders and made the OCD and related disorders. And that related disorder piece partially was looking at, are there other disorders that seem to be more comorbid with OCD? And that could be things like trichotillomania, excoriation, hoarding, those types of things too. So there does seem to be some genetic links in this population of potential manifestations of mental health issues.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And then, so one of the questions was, what increases my risk of OCD?
Well, there's probably a couple of things. Number one, what is your genetic makeup? We want to consider that. Number two, what kind of stressor have you experienced in your life? So as we look at that diathesis stress kind of model, we all have a genetic makeup that maybe makes us more prone to certain things and not prone to other things. But we also then have stressors in our life that the experience of a very high stressor, even in the presence of a low genetic predisposition, might be something that kicks it off. Mm-hmm. We might have a very high genetic predisposition, but not have a big stressor and never have it kicked off. And everybody else is going to be somewhere in the middle of all those things. So I really want to take a look at both. What's the family history and concerns? And not just OCD, but is there an anxiety disorder family history, depression family history, mood issues types of thing, eating disorders, you know, what those things that are also kind of related to OCD. Mm-hmm. And then if there are those, also, what kind of stressors has the person experienced? And I would say about half my patients, I can identify with them. There was this one thing that after that, I just really remember changing and being a little bit different. And the other half say, I was like this since I was a child, and I just kind of grew up this way, and it just kind of got worse and worse. So we still have a lot of work to do in that area to really discover exactly what that genetic mix is and how things are set off in the brain.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. And yeah, it's one of those questions that hopefully will get answered at some point by research. So I like this one, which is, if I fix one compulsion, so I guess by fix, that probably means removes, reduces. Will another one take its place or just take its place?
Yeah. So this question came out of a lot of critiques of exposure and response prevention therapy, saying to us that if we weren't getting to those underlying issues and really figuring them out, then this was just going to keep manifesting itself, you know, OCD whack-a-mole in such a way, right? Where, yeah, we figured one and then this popped up here and then it popped up here. Really, the goal that we're looking at with exposure and response prevention therapy is to teach you skills that will apply to any way that OCD may manifest itself. So what I have often found, and if you dig deep enough, I think that people doing OCD work would really see this, is that when I'm working with someone on, say, let's say it's a contamination issue and we really do well on it, and then suddenly some symmetry things pop up or maybe a harm thought pops up, what I typically have discovered in this is that those were older manifestations of OCD. So as you may be aware, and many of your listeners, the kind of OCD you first identify isn't necessarily the kind you finally go get treatment for, right? Many people will start off, well, I had contamination issues, then it switched to symmetry. And then when I started being afraid that I'd harmed people, that's when I really figured, oh my gosh, I really need therapy on this. Mm. So we work on the harm one, but now that we've done that, not surprising, those contamination or symmetry issues might kind of bubble up because they were being suppressed by how much they were working on the harm and afraid of the harm, that they just weren't paying attention to the symmetry or contamination things. Well, now we've addressed the harm one. Not surprising that some of those contamination or symmetry things pop up. The whole goal, though, use the same skills that we used for the harm stuff to apply to the symmetry and contamination. And hopefully we'll see very good results even quicker than what we did with the harm, because now they've practiced using those skills and they can apply to any other area of OCD.
Yeah, no, thank you for clarifying that. And one of my own questions off the back of that is, I'm just thinking in terms of what I've seen a lot in the community or where I've talked to people, and there's definitely like some panic sometimes around, I don't mean panic as in panic disorder, but just panic in the usual use of the word. Panic like that. And around, you know, I've worked really hard on this harm OCD, and oh no, suddenly I'm worried about this contamination issue, and it almost feels like they're back to square one, like a complete relapse. And I guess someone was expressing that feeling completely sort of powerless once again. How would you kind of speak to them? I guess I'm basically just looking at how you would basically say what you just said, but in a way of encouraging them to keep doing what they were doing before.
I'll take it out of OCD for a minute. You know, if I work with somebody who has an alcohol addiction and they smoke, and now we stop the alcohol, they're going to think, yeah, but I can't quit smoking. Well, you can. Now we have to apply what we did to help you with the alcohol to deal with the quitting of the smoking. So that we can very deeply hold on to an idea that, okay, that thing I can work on, but this one I can't, right? And for me, a big challenge is always looking at what are some of those cognitive distortions that people are really hanging on to that maintain people stuck in an area. And one of them is that word that I can't do it. And how can I help people challenge themselves to recognize that that's impairing you? That belief right there is one of the things that's impairing your getting better because you've already told yourself that you can't change. I believe that you can. And we already have evidence that says that the skills that you've been taught have worked in one area. There's not much reason why they wouldn't work in another area then. So let's help you transfer those skills to another area as well.
Yeah, no, I love it. Yeah, and I think that's the thing about themes is sometimes it can be seen as something completely different when in reality it's still OCD. It's just presenting slightly different.
Right. If I teach you how to do mechanic work on a Ford, and then a GM comes in or a Volvo comes in, are you going to be like, oh, I can't do it. I can't. Oh my God, no, I can't do it. Well, no, fundamentally, you can. You might have to learn a couple of little different odds and ends for the different engine, but the basics are there. Now we just have to adjust it to the new presentation.
Yeah, good point. Okay, cool. So, yeah, next question is, why do I have these thoughts when I don't want to?
That's exactly why you have them. I mean, that's my favorite answer right there. The reason you have them is because you don't want to have them. So I want everyone to picture a clock, all right? And we're going to start at 12 o'clock and we're going to go clockwise. And so imagine at 12 o'clock, OCD says to you, now, don't think of this, because if you do, something bad could happen. Well, guess what happens when you are told not to think of something?
Think
You
of it.
think of it, right? So now we're going down the clock. So now we're 1 o'clock. Oh crap, I just thought of it. And as we continue down the clock, our anxiety gets up more and more because we're thinking of it. And our OCD gets mad at us. And then our OCD says to us, yo, you've really screwed up now. The only way to get back in my good graces is to do these certain number of things a certain number of times, which I'll tell you as we're going along. Today it might be different than yesterday. And so then you have to do all these things, and we keep getting past 6 o'clock, we're at 7, and we're doing more and more of them. And finally, at about 10 o'clock, we do enough of them. And then our OCD says, oh, nice job. Welcome back. You are back in my good graces. We're at 11 o'clock. We have the little sweet spot there. We're feeling good. And then at midnight, OCD says, now, in order to remain in my good graces, just remember, don't think about that anymore. And we start the clock all over again. And I've been using that example lately with patients, and I think they really like it because they wonder, why am I stuck in this circle? Why does this just keep going around and around? And it really does come out of the pink elephant notion that once you're told not to think of a pink elephant, you think of one. Well, you have a disorder that consistently tells you not to think of something, which means all you're going to do is think of it. And then that same disorder punishes you for thinking of it, even though it's the reason why you thought of it in the first place.
Yeah, it's kind of sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a really good horror film, or horror film villain. So, no, I like that. And yeah, I guess that is cliche as it sounds. I like the saying of what you resist persists, and it kind of for me that always reminds me of OCD. Resisting the thought and the feelings, you kind of get more of it.
Yeah, there's a song line. My favorite band is Rush, and they have a song line that says, I can learn to resist anything but temptation. So I always love that.
Cool. All right. So, where's the next one gone? I like this question if I think it's what it is, which is what are the early manifestations of OCD? So yeah, I was gonna say I internalized or interpreted this as what does someone look like? How do they feel? What are they doing before it's full blown OCD? Or even in a child, are there early indications before it develops to OCD?
Yeah, Yeah, and that's kind of where I was thinking of that question too when I was looking at it and writing it. And when I basically what I did is I polled everyone I knew and said, "What do you want to know about OCD?" And I just got hundreds of questions emailed to me and compiled them into these questions in the book. And a lot of it comes out of things like maybe, oh, they're just a very picky eater, or well, they just don't like to hang out with people that are old, or whatever it is that in kids we kind of dismiss a lot of things as maybe quirky little things for them, but some of them may absolutely be early warning signs that there's obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, I don't say that to overpathologize children, and I don't want all of you who have kids being like, "Wait, is that OCD?" That's not what I'm saying. But if you're noticing more and more of these quirky kinds of things, and believe me, every child has quirky little things going, that's fine. But if there just seems to be more than the other children that you've had are appearing, or you're hearing that your friends' kids don't have all the numbers of these kinds of things going on that your kid does, it could be a sign that maybe there's some early onset OCD. We also want to know about like PANS or PANDAS, right? Pediatric autoimmune neuropsychological syndrome. So has your child had a strep throat or a Lyme disease issue or some kind of autoimmune thing that could be having antibodies that cross into the brain and then attack the basal ganglia, which are then manifesting as OCD-like symptoms or tics? So tics is another thing to look at. If you have an early onset of tics, that could be a sign that OCD might be somewhere in the mix as well too. And in fact, in the DSM-5, the new way that they did diagnosis was to check a little checkbox to say, is there presence of tics as well? So that's another one of those genetic kind of things that kind of let us know that there may be some concerns going on. So I just always look around for, number one, if I get that phone call from a family that said, "My kid went to bed last night fine, this morning they woke up with OCD," I say, "We got to look at PANS and see if there's an issue right there," because it can literally just happen overnight like that. And I've seen cases like that. And then the other piece is if the developmental level is kind of going askew of what all the other children were or the kids in their grade, and you're manifesting just more general levels of fear, more separation types of anxiety going on. All of those types of things may be some warning signs. If you're older, if you're noticing more kind of set patterns, and then we would want to diagnose a differentiation of maybe an autism spectrum issue, what we would call Asperger's in the past, who very much define certain patterns and things are the way they want them to be. Where does that end? Where does OCD begin? So some good differential diagnosis is also very important in those areas as well.
No, thank you for the distinctions. I think it's useful. And the next question is, I mean, there's many differing research on this, but how many people suffer from OCD?
Probably around 1 in 40 is what
Okay.
the agreed upon item or number is these days. So in the US here, that puts us at about 8.5 million people. And I would say if you're here's just one piece of treatment. If you're thinking that of those 8.5 million people, 10% of them need really, really intensive type of therapy, like a residential, and then you look at the number of residential beds in the world, which are less than 100 for OCD, that's just the people in the US. That's not including the UK, Europe, Asia, and everything else as well too. So that's why you see a lot of waiting lists at a lot of places.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, I mean, I guess that number's reassuring in the sense of if you have OCD, if you're in America, there's 8 million other people. If you're in the UK, I'm not going to do the maths, someone else can, but it's a lot of people. And other countries. But then, yeah, like you said, from the inpatient side of things, yeah, there needs to be more clinics and inpatient practices. Okay, so yeah, this one's a good one, I think, to clear up is how can you differentiate between OCD and normal fears and worries?
So a normal fear or worry would abate usually on its own, or maybe with a little bit of soothing that you get from someone else who says to you, "Oh, honey, it's okay. Don't worry about that." I would say no one with OCD has ever been calmed by being told not to worry about it. You'll be fine and everything will be okay. And
Yeah.
OCD fears then continuously come back, even if they do get reassurance or after the compulsion occurs, they creep back in and they do it again, even without any obvious external kind of trigger for it. It keeps coming back because it's now gone into the mind as a what if type of question. You know, I identify anxiety based issues with two words, and those are what if. And it's what if followed by the worst case scenario your brain can come up with at that time about whatever object or situation you find to be most disturbing or scary.
Yeah, I like that. What if are important words. And is there is it as clear cut as sometimes if it's a completely sort of ridiculous worry that it's more so OCD versus a normal fear or worry, or is it not always that black and white?
It's not always, really. I mean, because, you know, I've seen some amazingly way out there kinds of experiences that people will have as obsessions. And then I see day-to-day ones too. So if someone comes in my office and says, well, if it's a female, says, I don't want to sit there because maybe a male sat there, and if they left something there, I could get pregnant from that. Yeah, obviously that doesn't make a lot of sense to most people. And yet someone with OCD would go, oh yeah, I could see how that might happen, right? So I have to kind of separate out what Patrick is in day-to-day life and what Dr. McGrath does in the OCD world. And my job in the OCD world is to work on making the link of where did their OCD link this to that, to that, to that, to that, to that, to that, which, oh yeah, okay, well, that's how they got to that point, right? So I'm almost at the point that not much sounds all that strange or odd or weird to me anymore, because I figured out pretty well how to make all of those links to why somebody might believe something, even if there's a chain of 72 different possibilities that must occur in order to get there. I can still see that they would then say to me, but what if those 72 things did happen? And then it makes sense. So, it might be more difficult for newer therapists, I think, coming into the field, who might hear some of these more strange things and then wonder, is this a delusional issue or something like that? But as you get more into working with people with OCD and you just kind of realize the depth that OCD will take to try to make connections in the links of the chain in order to get from here to there. And then the jump. So let's say it's A to Z. Well, it started off as A to B, and then it was A, B, C, and then it was just A to C, and then it was A, C, D, and then A to D. And right. And at some point, finally, there's a trigger and boom, I'm at Z already. And I just automatically jump there. So that takes a lot of time and practice. And one thing that I enjoy really about training therapists is helping them to really develop the comfort in recognizing when something is obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That distinction. What was I say? So you do weekly webinars in the NoCD app.
I do. Yeah.
I got a fact. It was last night. I'm pretty sure it was last night. You did one.
Yep, I did. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Because I get the notifications to my phone, which is good, because I didn't do last night's one, but I'd forget usually if I didn't get them. So I guess, you know, and that is people can ask you questions.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't have to be doing therapy with you. They can just be using the app, the free version, and the community. So it's nice. It's a good opportunity to reach a therapist. So I guess my question is, what have been some of the most common questions you've been getting recently?
Well, one amazingly common one is, why do I have this thought or this image or this impulse, which goes back to what you kind of asked at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it's similar to that question, which is, I always say, because your OCD is kind of like a computer virus, and it's searching out the most vulnerable files and it's exploiting them. So in a way, OCD is searching through your brain and saying, hey, that might be contaminated. And if you're like, yeah, I don't care. Oh, okay, well, then it's not going to pick on that anymore. And then, hey, you might have hit someone with your car. No, it was a bump. Okay, whatever. And hey, you might think that child looks attractive. Oh my gosh, what if I, oh geez, that would be awful. And OCD is like ding, 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 ding. And now that's what it's just going to hammer and hammer you on going forward. So it really is a very sly disorder that is just kind of putting out feelers all over the place, trying to find out where it can really grip itself into. And then all it's going to do is become like an annoying little brother who's behind you going, hey, hey, I see your scan. I see your scan. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. But OCD is doing that. But hey, hey, don't think about this. Don't think about this. Don't think about this. And which makes you think about it. And then we go through that model I talked about, and that's what it is. So It's an opportunistic jerk is what OCD is, just searching out things. And so I always know what's amazingly important to people based on what their obsessions and compulsions are.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. What other things have come up for you on the webinars?
Well, the last few weeks have been, you know, questions around COVID and how do we do exposures in the world of COVID-19. There's been some concerns about, you know, substance use that we'll get as well, too. And how do we manage comorbid conditions? You know, I also have depression and all this. And now I'm feeling even more down or depressed, or I feel more urge to drink in these types of situations. So I think it's a struggle for people who do have some of the co-occurring disorders because they're hit with a double whammy here. You know, think about the people who are going to support group meetings who now can't go to those anymore. And that was one big thing that was helping keep them sober. If they haven't gone virtual, they've lost some of that connection now with people. So that can be a really big issue too. So I'm glad we're doing those webinars so that we can help to keep some kind of social connection amongst people. And then there's an underlying, and I try not to go into the reassurance piece too much of it, obviously, but there's always an underlying just wondering, am I a bad person, right? Because I have this thought. And so it's even beyond why do I have the thought I have, but the secondary part of it and so much underlying in many people with OCD is because I have this thought, does that mean that I'm a sick or a bad person for having it? And I always just try to get people to recognize that the thing to me that's bad is OCD, not the person who has OCD. And so what I want to do is help you get rid of the OCD. I don't want to change you or your personality or anything like that. But that question even came up last night, too. Somebody who said they'd had OCD their whole life and who didn't know what they would be like without having OCD. Mm-hmm. And they were scared to not have OCD because maybe in this sense, the devil you know is better the devil than you don't know. And what would their life be like if they didn't have it? Because all they knew how to do was to have it. So there've been some amazingly in-depth questions, and I'm really, really proud of people who are willing to kind of put themselves out there and to ask those questions and who are finally recognizing that there's a forum now where somebody understands. And I'm really proud of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's great. And is there anywhere that people, well, I guess the question is, are those webinars kind of you have to sign up and experience them and then they're gone forever, or are they stored and saved somewhere?
They're storing them, and we're working right now, I believe, on where we're going to be putting them up, but they are storing them so that people will have access to them. That should hopefully happen in the next week or two, actually.
Oh, fantastic. Cool. Well, let me know and I can push it out.
Absolutely.
Cool. So a couple of questions from me now, which is, what is an ideal ERP mindset?
It's okay to be uncomfortable. I want to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's my mindset that I try to get across with everybody, you know, and I like working with Stephen Smith at NoCD. You know, we're really working on that idea of get better, stay better. What are the things that we can do to help you get better? That's exposure and response prevention and whatever, other types of ancillary services we might need to work with, be that medications or be that consultations with people for if you have depression or other things going on, whatever those would be. And then what can we do to stay better? Keep doing your exposure and response prevention. Keep allowing yourself the ability to be uncomfortable with things so that you can continue to improve on your ability to handle being uncomfortable. So as long as people are willing to do something uncomfortable on purpose, they can do well in exposure therapy. But sometimes I do get that backlash from people who say, why would I ever do something uncomfortable on purpose? That makes no sense. My life is already so uncomfortable with things that happen randomly. Why would I ever do it on purpose? And so then it becomes my job to really explain to them why that is actually the key thing to their recovery and how all their quick acting safety behaviors they've been doing haven't fixed them because those aren't the right answers to this problem.
Yeah, and I got a feeling you mentioned that on the bonus episode we did recently about telehealth, where you, correct me if you didn't say this, or I'm sure if you didn't, you do say this, was and I'm forgetting now. So it's kind of the yes, doing the ERP is uncomfortable.
Right.
But then again, having OCD is uncomfortable. And one, one road leads to kind of, I don't want to say destruction, but doom and gloom. And one road leads to potentially getting your life back.
Right.
So if you're going to be uncomfortable, do the one that has the slightly better outcome.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. So you have two options here, this same level of discomfort or likely a bit more over time for the rest of your life, or some maybe even higher discomfort than you felt in a long time right now, which will last for a little bit of time and then feeling better after that. Mm-hmm. And that is sometimes the hardest thing to really get people to do. And sometimes I've even had people argue with me that say, I can't be any more uncomfortable than I am right now. I won't be able to handle being it. And so you'll appreciate this. You know, my favorite phrase is only an Irishman can tell you to go to hell and make you look forward to the journey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of what we have to do with exposure and response prevention therapy. How are we going to ask you to do something really uncomfortable and actually have you excited about it, look forward to it, do it, and learn from it that, wow, I handled that better than I ever thought that I could.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've talked about this a few times recently because I think it's important. I think when we talk about ERP, we often focus a lot on the exposures, right? It's the kind of sexy part of the treatment or the scary part, and that's why maybe we talk about it. But obviously the RP, the response prevention, is equally as important. And I guess, okay, firstly, what is it, and then why is it important for even the ERP, the E, to have any effect?
Yes. Well, in the words of Alec Pollard, who was my supervisor for my postdoc for 2 years, exposure without response prevention is failure, right? People are exposed constantly to things all the time. It doesn't mean they get better. So if you're exposed to something and you do your quick fix safety-seeking behavior solution, you're just going to learn how to feel better in the short term. You're not going to function better in the long run. Yeah. Only by doing response prevention, by eliminating avoidance, reassurance, distraction, substance use, and compulsions, will you actually learn that you can sit with the intrusive thought, image, or urge that pops in your head and not have to do something to make it go away, but that you can allow it to go away on its own, or to at least kind of abate a bit on its own. And we're looking at two things, right? The habituation model says that your anxiety will go down over time, and the inhibitory learning model says you'll have a belief change, and that belief change will show you that you can handle things better than you ever thought that you could. Mm-hmm. But you can't do that without stopping your typical responses to your obsessions, which are your compulsions or your substance use, or seeking reassurance from everyone you know that you're going to be fine or okay, or doing some kind of distraction technique so that you don't have to pay attention to the fact that you're uncomfortable, or avoiding anything in the first place to never be triggered. If you do those things, you'll always feel good in the moment and you'll never feel good in the long term. So we want to switch that role. We want to do response prevention, which is purposely stopping those things, which leads you to feeling uncomfortable in the short term, so that in the long run, you have the opportunity to learn that you can actually handle something better than you ever thought that you could. Mm.
Yeah, no, thank you for that clarity. I mean, it's an important one. I think it's sometimes, it's the last thing people kind of get their heads around. And yeah, I just wanted to do more to kind of explain that.
Thank you for that, because you're right. I mean, and I even try to not say exposure therapy anymore. I really try to say exposure and response prevention therapy as much as I can. And it's just constantly trying to remind myself that, and for my patients as well, that it's that response prevention piece that is so very important in this whole experience.
Yeah. No, thank you. And I think it's important. And yeah, if I've ever had my podcast has done any impact in terms of just talking about exposures, hopefully I can write some of those wrongs. I asked you in our last chat advice for your 20-year-old self. I'm now going to change that to your 30-year-old self, although I know that was only like a month ago.
Yeah, it was just about a month and 18 years ago.
So you know, you pick up that phone, call that 30-year-old Patrick, what would you tell him?
Get ready for change, because it's kind of amazing just thinking back to my career. I was just finishing my postdoc at age 30, Right. So I get my doctorate degree at 27. I'm done with my postdoc at 29, and I'm going into my first job, and it turned out to be a horrible job. I mean, it was just awful. I went somewhere because they said, "We really want to bring CBT to our staff, and we want you to come here and teach cognitive behavioral therapy." We've done very much just what they called, what did they call it? I probably blocked it out because it was such a bad experience. But they were thinking, oh yes, they said, "We just do developmental therapy. Everybody who comes in here is at the age of a college student and is just at a developmental stage where they just need guidance." And then people were coming in my office though who had OCD and who had panic disorder and agoraphobia and eating disorders and all these other things. And they were looking at me like, "Why are you diagnosing with people at age 19 with these disorders?" And I'd say, "Because they have them, that's why." And it was a really, really rough time in my life because I'm surrounded by all these people who are looking at me like, "The work you're doing is awful and horrible, and why are you doing it?" And yet I knew that it was the right thing to be doing, to be helping people. And so I would call myself now, if I could, back then, and just say, "Just hang on for a little bit because there's some really good stuff coming down the line." And it was, a year and a half after that that I got the call to open my first anxiety disorder clinic in Chicago. And I have now for 14 years been in charge of anxiety disorder clinics and treatment centers. And it's just been a great experience. But I had to go through some rough time, and I appreciate that in some way because I really learned how to handle myself when people push against exposure and response prevention therapy, or they push against CBT, to now be an even bigger defender of evidence-based treatment and why they're so important in our society.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. Oh, I like it. Okay, so you've got a billboard in Chicago. What do you want written on that billboard?
Oh, is this just for me or for my company?
Let's do you.
All right, for me, it would say, my goal for all of you is to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's what I would want it to say. And then if I had my company moniker, I would say, and no CD is here to help you do that.
Yeah.
That's what we want to do.
Two billboards next to each other.
Yeah.
Cool.
But I really do want people
Yeah.
to take that message home. It's okay
Yeah.
to become comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Absolutely. I think it's just so much of I think the words of kind of wisdom for OCD just apply to life generally. Sometimes many people have said like doing sort of OCD treatment, OCD therapy just helps you not with just the OCD, just life generally. So yeah, those billboard questions, I love them because they always bring up good stuff. So, anything else that you wish I would have asked you today?
Well, more of a statement than anything, thank you for all the work you do to make sure that the OCD community around the world has an opportunity to learn, because anything that we can do to stop people being in silence and to stop people from feeling alone is wonderful. And people like you who have the courage to tell your own story, and Stephen, and getting to work with people who have had OCD and still deal with the remnants of it, but have turned it around and try to put positive, good things out there in the world and be a model for people to show that even with OCD, success is very much an option in your life, and don't let it be something that you think is just screwed you over in some way, shape, or form. You can absolutely learn to live with something like that. And so just a thanks to you for continuing to do the work that you're doing to make sure that other people in the world know that they've got a friend somewhere.
No, it means a lot. There's and it's my honor. So thank you. Cool. All right, thank you so much for your time, and I really enjoyed this episode. I like the question format.
Great. Well, thank you, Sue. It's good to talk to you again, as always, and hope to see you soon.
So there you have it. Thank you to Dr. Patrick McGrath for giving his time, and to you guys for listening. And thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. And to find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. And the link will also be in the description of this episode. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Till we speak, take care.